Welcome to Barron's Passkey to the TOEFL IBT 6th Edition, copyright 2006 by Barron's Educational Series, Incorporated. Do you know what a passkey is? A passkey is a master key, a key that opens every door. This book and the audio CDs were designed to help you prepare for the IBT, the Internet-based TOEFL. After you have succeeded on the TOEFL, other doors will open for you. But first, you need a passkey to unlock the TOEFL. On the audio CDs, you will hear the script for Model Test 2 and Model Test 3 in the book. Congratulations for choosing the leader in test preparation. More than 1 million students have used Barron's books, audio CDs, and CD-ROMs to succeed on the TOEFL. You can be successful, too. Here is the key. Let's begin.
Model Test 2. Listening Section.
The Listening Section tests your ability to understand spoken English that is typical of interactions and academic speech on college campuses. During the test, you will respond to conversations and lectures. This is the short format for the Listening Section. On the short format, you will respond to 2 conversations and 4 lectures. After each listening passage, you will answer 5 to 6 questions about it. You will hear each conversation or lecture 1 time. You may take notes while you listen, but notes are not graded. You may use your notes to answer the questions. Choose the best answer for multiple choice questions. Follow the directions on the page or on the screen for computer-assisted questions. Click on Next and OK to go to the next question. You cannot return to previous questions. You have 25 to 30 minutes to answer all of the questions. A clock on the screen will show you how much time you have to complete your answers for the section. The clock does not count the time you are listening to the conversations and lectures.
Listening 1. Professor's Office.
Listen to part of a conversation between a student and a professor.
Professor James, do you have a minute?
Sure. Come on in. What can I do for you?
Well, I did pretty well on the midterm.
You sure did. One of the best grades, as I recall.
But I missed a question, and I'd appreciate it if you could help me understand what I did wrong. I have the test right here, and I just can't figure it out.
Okay, fire away.
It's question 7, the one on biotic provinces and biomes.
Oh, that one. Quite a few people missed it. I was thinking that we should go over it again in class. But anyway, let's look at your answer.
Thanks. Here's the thing. I said that a biotic province was a region with similar life, but with boundaries that prevent plants and animals from spreading to other regions. So an animal, for example, a mammal, it may have a genetic ancestor in common with another mammal. But a biome's a similar environment, an ecosystem really, like a desert or a tropical rainforest. So in the case of a biome, well, the similar climate causes the plants and animals to evolve, to adapt to the climate, and that's why they look alike.
That's good. Very good, as far as you went. But there's a second part to the question. Look, right here. Include an explanation of convergent and divergent evolution. So I was looking for a more complete answer. Next time, be sure to include both parts of a question, when there are 2 parts, like this one. Do you know how to explain convergent and divergent evolution?
I think so. Isn't it like when a group of plants or animals, when they're separated by mountains or a large body of water, then subpopulations evolve from a common ancestor and they have similar characteristics, but their development diverges because of the separation. So that's why we call it divergent evolution.
Right. Even when the habitat's similar, if they're separated, then they diverge. How about convergent evolution then?
Well, that would be a situation where a similar environment, a habitat, it may cause plants and animals to evolve in order to adapt to the conditions. So a species that isn't really related can evolve with similar characteristics because it can look like a species in another geographic region because of adaptation. And that would be convergent evolution?
Right again. So temperature and rainfall, proximity to water, latitude and longitude all combine to determine the climate. And if we know the climate of an area, then we can actually predict what kind of life will inhabit it.
Okay. And I really did know that. I just didn't put it down. To tell the truth, I didn't see the second part, not until you pointed it out to me.
That's what I thought. Well, Jerry, it's a good idea to double-check all the questions on a test, not just my test, any test, to make sure you've answered each part of the question completely. Otherwise, you won't get full credit.
I see that. Well, live and learn.
Jerry, you're one of my best students.
Thanks. I really like biology. In fact, I'm thinking of majoring in it.
Good. That means you'll be in some of my upper-level classes.
And I'll be watching out for those two-part questions on your exams.
And all the rest of your exams. I'll be honest with you, my questions usually have two parts, so the students will have an insight into the grading system. And a lot of professors do that. In an essay question, it's difficult to know what to include and how much to write. Just read the question carefully and be sure to include all the parts. There may be three or four in some essay questions. This is the way that the professor helps you organize your answer. I'm giving my students a hint about what I'm looking for by including several parts to the question. But if you miss one of the parts, then it lowers your score.
That makes sense. I think I was just trying to finish within the time limit and I didn't read as carefully as I should have. On the final, I'll spend more time reading the questions before I start to answer them.
Good plan.
1. Why does the man go to see his professor? 2. Listen again to part of the conversation, and then answer the following question.
Thanks. Here's the thing. I said that a biotic province was a region with similar life, but with boundaries that prevent plants and animals from spreading to other regions.
Why does the man say this?
Thanks. Here's the thing.
Three. What did the man do wrong? Four. According to the student, what is divergent evolution? Five. What will Jerry probably do on the next test?
Listening to Art History Class.
Listen to part of a discussion in an art history class.
Sorry about the tests. I don't have them finished. They just took longer to grade than I thought they would. So I'll have them for you next time. Okay, then. Let's begin our discussion of the ballet. If you read the chapter in your text, you already know that in 1489... a performance that was something like a dinner theater was organized to celebrate the marriage of the Duke of Milan, and a dance representing Jason and the Argonauts was performed just before the roasted lamb was served. By the way, it's interesting that the dance was called an entree, and that name has been retained for courses and meals. Anyway, about the same time, outdoor entertainment, you know, parades and equestrian events, they were becoming more popular, and we have evidence that they were referred to as horse ballets.
So this, the horse ballet, was it the first time the term ballet was used?
Right. The actual term in Italian was balletti, which meant a dance done in figures, and it was characterized by the arrangement of the performers in various patterns. Actually, the balletti were staged versions of the social dances that were popular at court. And the steps, the basic movements, they were walking, swaying, and turning. So they combined in a variety of sequences, each of which was named so that they could be referred to in the directions for individual dances. In fact, specific instructions for the placement of the dancers' feet probably provided the first record of the five positions of classical ballet. Question?
Sorry, I'm trying to get clear on the dancers. Could you explain what the book means about court dancing? And, I'm not saying this very well.
I think I know where you're going. You see, the directions that were written down were intended as a reference for social dancing. But they were important in the history of ballet because the theatrical dances or entertainments that preceded ballet were not performed by professional dancers. Members of the court danced for the entertainment of society, and in general, the performances were in the central halls of castles and palaces with the audience seated in galleries above so that the floor figures could be seen when the people looked down. But back to your question. Because of the limitations of the performers and the arrangement of the staging, well, the best way to impress the audience was to keep the steps simple enough for the amateur dancers, but the geometrical patterns had to be intricate and fresh, so the spectators would go away pleased because they'd seen something new.
Oh, I get it now. That makes sense, too, because everyone would be looking down at the dancers.
Exactly. Now, to continue that thought for a moment, by the middle of the 16th century, variety shows were being presented on a grand scale in northern Italy. They included both indoor and outdoor entertainment, and most people called them spettacoli. And France had begun to make a significant contribution to the dance form that evolved into modern ballet. But to be precise, it was Catherine de' Medici who used dance as part of her court entertainments and is credited with the use of the term ballet. In 1573, I think it was 1573, anyway, she organized a huge celebration to welcome the ambassadors from Poland who had arrived to offer their country's throne to her son Henri. So she called it the Polish Ballet, and the production was staged on a landing at the top of a grand staircase. 16 ladies, and these would not have been dancers, just members of court, so they represented the 16 provinces of France, and they performed a choreographed dance with a variety of floor figures. Afterward, the audience joined in court dances, similar to the ballroom dancing that evolved later. So that's a long answer to your original question.
Now, I have a question.
Okay.
You said that the Polish ballet was the first ballet, but I thought the book said the first ballet was Queen Louise's ballet.
Good question. Well, I said the Polish ballet was the first use of the term ballet for a dance performance, but Queen Louise's ballet is generally considered the first modern ballet. As you'll remember from the book, the ballet was performed before 10,000 guests, and it was 5 hours long. When I was doing the research for this lecture, I saw several references to the time, so I know that this is accurate. But I kept thinking, no one would watch a ballet for 5 hours. But it must be correct. I can only assume that other activities were going on simultaneously, like a banquet and conversation, don't you think? Anyway, what makes Queen Louise's ballet so unique, besides the length, and why it's the first modern ballet, is that it was connected by a storyline, or in technical terms, it's called dramatic cohesion. Each scene was related to the tales of Circe, a Greek enchantress, who used her powers to battle with man and the gods. The triumph of good, portrayed by Jupiter over evil, portrayed by Circe, was told in a, let's call it a unified production.
6. What is the discussion mainly about? Seven. Listen again to part of the lecture and then answer the following question.
So I'll have them for you next time. Okay then, let's begin our discussion of the ballet.
Why does the professor say this?
Okay then.
Eight. According to the professor, what does the term balletti mean? 9. How did the early choreographers accommodate the abilities of amateur performers? Ten. Why does the professor mention that he checked several references about the length of Queen Louise's ballet? 11. What can be inferred about the professor?
3. Linguistics class.
Listen to part of a discussion in a linguistics class.
What comes to mind when I say the word grammar?
That's easy. English class and lots of rules.
Memorizing parts of speech, like nouns and verbs.
Diagramming sentences.
Well, yes, that's fairly typical, but today we're going to look at grammar from the point of view of the linguist. And to do that, we really have to consider three distinct grammars for every language. The first grammar is referred to as a mental grammar, and that's what a speaker of a language knows, often implicitly, about the grammar of that language. This has also been called linguistic competence, and from that term, competence grammar has become popular. I like to think of it of mental or competence grammar. I like to think of it as an incredibly complex system that allows a speaker to produce language that other speakers can understand. It includes the sounds, the vocabulary, the order of words and sentences, and even the appropriateness of a topic or a word in a particular social situation. And what's so amazing is that most of us carry this knowledge around in our heads and use it without much reflection. One way to clarify mental or competence grammar is to ask a friend a question about a sentence. Your friend probably won't know why it's correct, but that friend will know if it's correct. So, one of the features of mental or competence grammar is this incredible sense of correctness and the ability to hear something that sounds odd in a language. Haven't you had the experience of hearing a sentence and it stood out to you? It just wasn't quite right. For native speakers, we can call this ability native intuition. But even language learners who've achieved a high level of competence in a second language will be able to give similar intuitive responses even if they can't explain the rules. So, that's mental grammar or competence grammar. Okay then, that brings us to the second type of grammar, and this is what linguists are most concerned about. This is descriptive grammar, which is a description of what the speakers know intuitively about a language. Linguists try to discover the underlying rules of mental or competence grammar and describe them objectively. So descriptive grammar is a model of competence grammar, and as such, it has to be based on the best effort of a linguist, and consequently subject to criticism and even disagreement from other linguists. Because no matter how skilled a linguist is, describing grammar is an enormous task. In the first place, the knowledge is incredibly vast and complex. In the second place, the language itself is changing even while it's being described. And finally, the same data can be organized in different but equally correct ways in order to arrive at generalizations. And the ultimate goal of a descriptive grammar is to formulate generalizations about a language that accurately reflect the mental rules that speakers have in their heads. But getting back to what most people think of as grammar, the grammar that we may have learned in school, that's very different from either competence grammar or descriptive grammar because the rules aren't meant to describe language at all. They're meant to prescribe and judge language as good or bad. And this kind of grammar is called, not surprisingly, prescriptive grammar because of its judgmental perspective. Again, to contrast prescriptive grammar with descriptive grammar, just think of descriptive generalizations as accepting the language that a speaker uses in an effort to describe it and recognizing that there may be several dialects that are used by various groups of speakers and that any one speaker will probably choose to use different language depending on the formality, for example, of the situation. On the other hand, prescriptive rules are rigid and subject to enforcement. Prescriptivists want to make all speakers conform to one standard in all situations. And that tends to be a very formal level of language all the time. Now, which of these types of grammar do you think you were learning in school when you had to memorize parts of speech and rules and diagram sentences?
Sounds like prescriptive grammar to me.
Precisely. But how did prescriptive rules get to be accepted, at least in the schools? And probably even more important, why are so many of these rules disregarded even by well-educated speakers in normal situations?
Did you say disregarded?
I did. Some of you may recall that during the 17th and 18th centuries in Europe, Latin was considered the perfect language and was used by the educated classes. The argument for the perfection of Latin was reinforced by the fact that Latin had become a written language, and consequently, Latin had stopped changing in the normal ways that spoken languages do. So the rules were also fixed, and for many writers of English during that period, the rules of Latin were held as a standard for all languages, including English. But the problem was that English had a different origin and very different constructions. For example, how many times have you heard the prescriptive rule, never end a sentence with a preposition? This is a Latin rule, but it doesn't apply to English. So it sounds very formal and even strange when this Latin rule is enforced. Now, how many of you would say, what are we waiting for? I think most of us would prefer it to, for what are we waiting? But as you see, this breaks the rule, the Latin rule, that is.
So we're really learning Latin rules in English classes. No wonder I was confused. But wouldn't you think that, well, that things would change? I mean, Latin hasn't been recognized as a world language for a long time.
You're right, but the reason that prescriptive rules survive is the school system. Teachers promote the prescriptive grammar as the standard for the school and, consequently, for the educated class. And good language is a requisite for social mobility, even when it's very dissimilar to the mental grammar or the descriptive grammar of a language.
12. What is the discussion mainly about? Thirteen. How does the professor make his point about native intuition? 14. What are two key problems for descriptive grammar? 15. Listen again to part of the lecture and then answer the following question.
But how did prescriptive rules get to be accepted, at least in the schools? And probably even more important, why are so many of these rules disregarded even by well-educated speakers in normal situations?
Did you say disregarded?
Why does the student say this?
Did you say disregarded?
Sixteen. According to the professor, why were Latin rules used for English grammar? 17. Why does the professor discuss the rule to avoid ending a sentence with a preposition?
4. College campus.
Listen to part of a conversation on campus between two students.
I didn't see you at the International Talent Show.
No time for that kind of thing.
You mean you don't belong to the ISA?
The ISA?
International Student Association.
Oh no, I don't belong to any clubs.
But this isn't like a regular club.
How so?
Well, we have a house. You know, the brick house on Fraternity Row.
You live there, right?
Yeah. I moved in last year. It's really inexpensive because we take care of the house ourselves and we cook our own meals.
That sounds like it would take a lot of time.
Not really. There's a list of chores posted every week and you can choose something you like to do. So I usually put my name down for yard work. I like being outside, so it's fun for me.
But you have to cook too, right?
Okay, it's like this. 20 of us live there, so every night, 2 of the guys cook and 2 of the guys clean up. So you only have to cook about once a week and clean up once.
What about breakfast and lunch?
Oh, well, you're on your own for that. But the dinners are just fantastic. It's like eating in a different ethnic restaurant every night. You know, because the guys are from different countries.
Well, that sounds good.
And it costs about half what it did to live in the dorm. But really, I'm doing it because it's a great experience living with people from so many different countries. My best friend in the house is from Korea. My roommate's from Brazil. And I've got friends from, well, just about everywhere.
But you don't have to live in the house to belong to the club.
No, no. There are about 100 members in the International Student Association. Only guys live in the house. But there are a lot of women in the association.
I wish I had time to do it. It really sounds interesting.
You've got to relax sometimes. Anyway, we meet at the house the first Friday of the month from 7 to 10. We have a buffet dinner, and after that, we have a short meeting. That's when we plan our activities, like the talent show and picnics and dances. Then a lot of the people stay for music and a party, but some people leave after the meeting.
So it's only a couple hours a month?
Right. Listen, why don't you come over next Friday for the meeting, as my guest, I mean. You have to eat anyway, and if you have a good time, you can think about joining.
Next Friday? Well, I don't know. I usually study on Friday night, but I could take a break. Sure, I'll come over, but I might have to leave early.
Great.
18. What is the purpose of this conversation? 19. What does the man imply about the house where he is living? 20. How does the man feel about the International Student Association? 21. Listen again to part of the conversation, and then answer the following question.
Then a lot of the people stay for music and a party, but some people leave after the meeting.
So it's only a couple hours a month?
What does the woman mean when she says this?
So it's only a couple hours a month?
22. What does the woman agree to do?
5. Zoology class.
Listen to part of a lecture in a zoology class. The professor is discussing coral reefs.
Every ecosystem on Earth is unique. But the coral reef is perhaps the most unusual of all, because it's the only ecosystem made by and made of animals. All coral reefs are constructed by coral polyps, which are generally small, about the size of this pencil eraser. But the structures themselves are, well, enormous. Astronauts have been able to identify the Great Barrier Reef in Australia from space. Can you believe that? And the diversity of species in large coral reefs is second only to the rainforest habitats. In fact, we estimate that for every species we've identified on a coral reef, there are probably 100 times that number that remain to be classified and studied. But how do these little polyps build such impressive reefs? Well, hard corals secrete a shell of calcium carbonate around their bodies. The polyp isn't hard, you see. But the shell is. And these shells are the material that forms a coral reef. So a coral reef is just a colony, millions and millions of coral animals whose shells are connected. And reproduction is really the basis for the construction of a large reef. You see, as each polyp matures, it converts the calcium and other minerals in ocean water to a hard limestone exoskeleton called a coralite. And this is fascinating. Although the polyps themselves don't appreciably increase in size, they continue to build new shells periodically, connecting them with partitions. Now, coral can reproduce sexually through an activity called mass spawning. During one night in the spring when the moon's full, coral polyps release egg bundles that contain both eggs and sperm. Most polyps have both male and female reproductive cells. The egg bundles are round, about half the size of marbles, I'd say. They're brightly colored in orange or red or pink, and they float up to the surface to form a thick layer of, well, think of them as rather fragrant beads. So with the water so saturated with them, predators will only be able to devour a small number compared with the huge number that will survive and break open. The sperm cells swim away to fertilize the eggs from another bundle. So, once fertilized, the little egg begins to mature from a coral larva to a planule, which can swim for a few hours, days, or even a few weeks. Ultimately, it locates a hard surface on which to attach itself and from which it will not move for the rest of its life except for the movement involved in the process of building a new, neighboring shell as it continues to mature. But actually, sexual reproduction isn't the way that coral reefs are really constructed. When a polyp matures on the site it's selected, the habitat is identified as being conducive to reef building. So the mature polyp doesn't just grow bigger, it actually replicates itself in a process called budding. After the genetic material is duplicated, then the polyp divides itself in half, and each half becomes a completely mature polyp. This budding process repeats itself, eventually producing thousands of asexually budded coral polyps connected by a tissue that grows over the limestone shells between the polyps. So, as you can imagine, budding will produce a large number of individual polyps, but they'll all have exactly the same genetic code as the first polyp. And this creates the beginning of a coral reef, but without the diversity that eventually populates the habitat. Wherever a coral reef's constructed, abundant sea life congregates. In fact, it's been estimated that about 25% of all ocean species can be found within the coral reefs. Now, most coral polyps eat plankton, single-celled microscopic organisms that float or swim very slowly in the ocean water in their habitat. But a coral reef has such a high concentration of polyps, they can't rely solely on plankton to survive. So coral polyps have developed a symbiotic relationship with a single-celled algae called zooxanthella. Remember that to qualify as symbiotic, a relationship must be mutually beneficial. So the zooxanthella produces food for the coral through the byproducts of photosynthesis, and the coral provides a safe home for the zooxanthella because it's hidden from predators that inhabit the coral reef. Every species of coral grows at a different rate, some as much as 6 inches a year. But faster-growing colonies are more prone to breaking apart, either from their own weight or from the continuous force of the ocean waves. Some species tend to grow more slowly, but they may live as long as 1,000 years. Even so, only the top portion of any reef is actually alive and growing, and the lower structure is comprised of the skeletal remains. That's limestone coralite from coral that has died. And what I find incredibly interesting about coral reefs is that each is a unique structure. But of course, scientists need to classify, and so there's a classification system for coral reefs. A fringing reef grows around islands and the shorelines of continents and extends out from the shore. In order to flourish, fringing reefs must have clean water, lots of sunshine, and a moderately high concentration of salt. Some good examples of fringing reefs can be found around the Hawaiian Islands. Oh, yes, these are the most common and also the most recently formed class of coral reefs. Here's a drawing of a fringing reef. I think this is actually one of the Hawaiian reefs. Now, barrier reefs, they're found further from shore and they're usually separated from the shoreline by a shallow body of water, maybe a lagoon. As in the case of the Great Barrier Reef off the shore of Australia, the body of water can be miles wide, so the reef's miles away from the shoreline. And there may actually be a collection of coral reefs fused together. This is a drawing of a reef in the Great Barrier Chain. As I recall, there are about 25 or maybe even more individual coral reefs connected to form the Great Barrier Reef. As a general rule, barrier reefs are larger and older than fringing reefs. But the oldest class of coral reef is the atoll, which is a ring-shaped reef with a lagoon in the middle and deep water surrounding the ring. These are scattered throughout the South Pacific, kind of like oasis settlements in the desert, and they abound with a diversity of sea life. This is one of the South Pacific atolls. So, as we reflect on everything we've said about coral, we know that it's a relatively simple organism with a body ending in a mouth and tentacles. It reproduces both sexually and asexually by budding, and it survives by forming a symbiotic relationship with Zooxanthella. But none of this is very extraordinary. What's unique about coral in the animal kingdom is its ability to construct a variety of reefs, creating habitats that are absolutely unlike any others on Earth.
23. According to the professor, how do coral reefs grow? Twenty-four. Why are so many egg bundles released during mass spawning? 25. According to the professor, what is budding? 26. What is the relationship between Zooxanthella and coral polyps? 27. Which of the following reefs is probably an atoll? 28. In the lecture, the professor explains coral reefs. Indicate whether each of the following is a true statement about coral reefs. Click in the correct box for each phrase.
6. Business class.
Listen to part of a discussion in a business class.
Industry analysts report that multinational food companies are trying to use the same types of strategies that automobile and electronics manufacturers have found to be successful in the global marketplace. The problem is that general rules for products that tend to be traditional for national or even regional tastes, these products are very difficult to identify, and sales aren't easy to project. But the companies that tend to do best are those that are the most responsive to local tastes. And they spend development dollars on taste testing in the local markets before they formulate the final product. Can anyone recall any examples from the case studies in the text? Sandy?
McDonald's Big Mac has more mustard in the special sauce in Paris than it does in New York.
Because?
Because taste tests verified that people in the United States liked sweeter condiments than people did in France. In fact, I think the sugar content for export foods in general usually has to be modified when American products are taste tested overseas.
Right you are. Probably the company that's adapted most to local tastes is Nestlé. Can you believe that they produce more than 200 slightly different blends of Nescafé for export to different countries? Amazing, but true. But sometimes taste is less a problem of ingredients and more a matter of the way a food product looks or feels. One case study that comes to mind is the one about the soft cookies that just don't sell as well in England as crisp cookies. So you can see that taste extends way beyond just flavor. It's really a combination of flavor preferences and local expectations. Look, here's another example of accommodation that had more to do with the expectation for a process than the flavor of the product. In this case study, it was cake. Remember when Betty Crocker cake mixes were introduced in England, they weren't accepted because the English homemaker felt more comfortable with convenience foods that required more than water to prepare them. Go figure. But that was the problem uncovered by extensive market research. So when the mix was reformulated without an egg, and the preparation included adding an egg with the water before mixing it, well, Betty Crocker cake mixes became very popular in England. Any other examples come to mind? They don't have to be from the case studies in the book.
How about serving sizes?
Go on.
Well, soft drinks for one. Just compare the serving sizes in the United States and many foreign markets where soft drinks are sold. The cans in foreign markets are much smaller because consumers expect it. But in the United States, well, supersizing is probably a consideration when a foreign company is trying to crack the American market.
That's a great example. So the taste can be acceptable, but the packaging has to compare favorably with the competing brands and the public's expectations.
Yeah, but that makes products more expensive, doesn't it? I mean, because you can't standardize the product or the packaging, so that would make it more costly to produce, wouldn't it?
Right you are, Chris. In fact, you've really gone to the heart of the issue. A compromise has to occur between the requirement that products be adapted to please the taste and the expectations of local consumers and the pressure to standardize products for maximum cost effectiveness. Now, let's complicate that even further. Even the experts don't agree on the importance of how far to go in adapting products for local markets. A few years ago, Ted Levitt, he's the editor of the Harvard Business Review, Levitt predicted what he called a pluralization of consumption. What he means is that, at least in some areas, tastes are likely to converge, which makes sense when you think about the increased opportunities for travel and sampling of foods, as well as the continued global marketing efforts by multinational corporations. So, logically, it's smarter to simply identify the areas in which tastes are most likely to be the same and concentrate efforts on those food products. But there's also the issue of global marketing. How about the potential to create taste? I mean, selling the image that surrounds using a product. If consumers want to associate themselves with that image, won't they develop a taste for the product that does that for them? For example, there's some evidence that the popularity of products seen in movies and television spills into the foreign marketplace. This subtle brand association with the movie or the celebrities in it translates into high-dollar deals for certain brands to be visibly displayed in widely distributed films.
Oh, right. I was reading about that. It was in a couple of the case studies. The bottle, a can, or a package appears as part of the character's persona. And if it's a character that audiences choose to identify with, then the taste for the product may follow. Or at least that's what the marketing experts are betting on.
And that includes foreign audiences. Anyone drink Starbucks coffee? Well, Starbucks began as a regional coffee in Seattle, Washington, and made the global leap in 2000, opening shops in China, a huge market, surely, but also a traditionally tea-drinking society. So what's the attraction? Starbucks is marketing to the cosmopolitan consumer, the young trendy set looking for a modern image as well as a different taste. Still, there have been some real surprises in the multinational dinner party. No one has really figured out why the Italians, Germans, and British love Kraft's Philadelphia cream cheese, and the Greeks simply don't buy it. And why did Perrier, a mineral water from France, why did Perrier take America by storm while other imported mineral waters didn't? In short, success in the food export industry is probably a combination of the real taste, the flavor of the product, with some adaptation for the local markets, the satisfaction of certain expectations for the preparation and packaging, and the taste for the product created by images in the global marketing plan. Add to this mix the potential for a short shelf life or even perishable products, and, well, you have a very challenging problem for the multinational food industry.
29. What is the discussion mainly about? 30. How does the professor organize the lecture? 31. Listen again to part of the lecture, and then answer the following question.
Any other examples come to mind? They don't have to be from the case studies in the book.
How about serving sizes?
Why does the student say this?
How about serving sizes?
32. What technique does the professor use to encourage student discussion? 33. What did Ted Levitt mean by the pluralization of consumption? 34. What does the professor say about television and movie companies?